Hi, welcome to Critical Q&A number 444, live edition, daylight savings time edition. So I'm sure there are a few, sleepy eyes out there as I'm sitting here sorting out my head. Good morning, everybody. 444. Yeah, I know. Coming up on 450 in a few weeks, I guess a month and a half. And, 500 after that. Oh, my God. So many questions answered. So much information here for you guys. Good morning. Let's go ahead and get the Q&A portion of this set up. So let me click into the little start a Q&A. Please put your questions under this comment so I can answer them. All questions go here. Start Q&A. All right. So I have thrown that up on the screen there now. And let's go ahead and click over to the chat screen. And as you can see, I changed it. What do you mean I can't hear you? Yeah, I think we're okay sound wise. Please, I hope that gets fixed on your end, Joe. So I changed up the screen here a little bit so that when I throw questions up, they'll be very crystal clear along the bottom of the screen there in the bottom third. And I took out the messaging about supporting the channel. Maybe I'll stick that somewhere else, but I'll just message here. I'll just include that right now. That this channel, this work, everything I'm doing here is entirely fan-funded by you guys. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate the support and the love that I get from you guys. Factually, I could use a bit more. So I'm hoping that the quality of work here, reflects something that is entertaining, informative, and educational, and something that's worth supporting. That's been, my effort from the very beginning. So just gonna put that out there. You can support this channel through Patreon, PayPal, Venmo, Buy Me a Coffee. However you want to do it, yeah, we can work it out. I also have, I have about three or four copies of the Scientology A to Xenu that you can purchase from me, which I will sign for you and customize for you and send to you if you so desire. I've literally just got a couple of those left. And, good, YouTube's all fixed. Great. Oh, and thank you for gifting those memberships, Laura. That's very, very kind of you. How many total questions? Well, it's an average of 8 questions per episode. But when we get into the lives, that average really gets busted out because sometimes in a live stream, I can answer up to 20, 25, 30 questions if we're really getting going. But actually, I don't think I've ever done 30. I've probably done around 20 max. But what is that? That's a lot. That's 8, 4, 32. It's a lot. So thousands of answers to your questions. is that about 4,000, 3,200 to 4,000 answers, something like that in there? Here, let's throw that on the screen. Is that going to appear there? I think it will. There it is. Okay, good. It's a little lag on when I'm watching the live stream on my end. So let's get to your questions as I see they're coming in here. Looks like this one's still coming in. Elk of Antioch is putting in a two-part answer or question there, and I'm about the Nation of Islam, so we'll get to that in just a moment. Let me comment on this before anybody even has to ask, because I've been keen to talk about this, and I mentioned it Friday, and so when I think X Zion asked me about it, Dune 2, or Dune Part 2, the movie. We just watched it last night, yesterday, 3 hours, 2 hours, 45-minute movie. I'll tell you, these days, you might as well not even walk into the theater until about 25 minutes into the showtime, because I can't believe, I haven't been to a movie in a while, you know, in the theater, and I just cannot believe the commercials after commercials. Like, when did this happen that you go to a movie to watch commercials? I'm surprised they haven't started inserting them into the middle of the damn movie. So we had this whole like 20 minutes, 25 minutes of commercials and then previews that were basically showing me the entire movie. When did, you know, trailers that show you the entire movie, why bother going to see it if you've already seen it in the trailer? You know, tease me, give me a mystery, give me some compelling reason to go want to see your movie. That's what a trailer is for. It's not to show me the entire movie, you nerds. Oh, I don't know how this industry got so turned upside down, but I'll tell you, we are living in an advertising insanity these days. They just can't advertise to us enough. All the streaming platforms now in the middle of our movies. Anyway, I'm not going to stop ranting about this. Sorry. You didn't come here to hear me ranting about commercials. But when we finally got to the movie and watched the movie, okay, so Dune Part 2 is kind of important and interesting because, of course, it has themes that relate an awful lot to the stuff we talk about here all the time, you know, religious fervor, cultic followings, people who will commit extreme acts, even kill or murder in the name of a prophet or a vision or a belief system. And the value of that, the relative, you know, the effects of that, the consequences of that. And that's not all that Dune is actually about. The movie version, Denis Villeneuve's version of this, very, very much focuses on that aspect of the story and the religious messiah figure that Paul Atreides must become in order to lead the Fremen and accomplish his goals immediately of, you know, vengeance for his family and for, you know, his entire bloodline being massacred. And I don't know that I'm really going to be a lot of real afraid here today in talking about this, about spoilers. Dune has been around since 1965 as a literary work, and it's been turned into movies like three times. So you know, if you don't know about it and you're, you know, like holding out on, oh God, no, don't tell me anything about it, maybe you're in the wrong place right now, because I'm going to go into it. But... Okay, there's a lot of focus on the religious messiah aspect of this. In fact, having read the books many, many years ago, and admittedly a lot of it going over my head back then because I was a Scientologist, I was a kid, I really didn't have enough life experience to appreciate the themes that Herbert was exploring in the books as adequately as I think I might now. And that's why I've done so much, you know, catch up and re-looking at the old book material and watching videos about it and stuff. I mean, it's a very, very famous, it's like Lord of the Rings famous in the sci-fi universe amongst the fan base, right? There's a lot of people who have been into Dune for a long time. And like I said, it goes deep on exploring some of these themes. And so the Paul Atreides character being watched as sort of the hero, he has a hero's journey through the first novel of Dune, where he starts off as a young man and he has to go through this conflict and his family is destroyed and goes out in the desert and becomes allied with the Fremen, this desert people. And this is 10,000 years in the future. This is a long ass time away from now. So the cultures have totally changed. This is all on different planets. Earth is a long distant memory. But it's kind of clear that these families and the royal houses and the way that the world is set up in this universe of Herbert's, that it all, you know, sort of came from Earth many, 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 many years ago. Anyway, I felt the movie, getting to the movie and my critique of it, I felt it kind of hit you over the head a little bit. It was a little too expository, a little bit too, like, let's explain every little tiny bit in detail to you in case you miss it. And I felt like that was a little bit of a disservice to the audience compared to the first part. I thought Dune Part 1 was a little bit more, here you go, here's the world, here's the story, here are the people, and we're not necessarily going to tell you everything that's going on. You're just going to have to kind of follow and watch and pay attention and figure out the relationships and how this all works. And there's enough explanation that you kind of figure some things out, but not a lot. Part two kind of overcompensates, I felt, in the other direction. And I felt like it was really hitting you over the head with the whole struggle of, you know, Paul's personnel conflict of resisting and not wanting to be this, you know, religious figure, because he predicted correctly that it would bring about this, you know, sort of universal jihad that would end up killing billions of people. Right, that's the consequence of him engaging in this activity. You allying with the Fremen and doing everything he does brings about a future where there's this universal jihad, and he can see that coming, and he doesn't want that, and he doesn't want to let that happen. But it's there's the conflict in the book series and again the themes that are explored, where it's sort of like, well, how much power of choice does that individual have in the bigger picture with all of the cultural factors and power factors arrayed against him? What else could he do anyway, right? This is a very, as he shows in the movie, this is a path through. Every other path, you know, ends up with him dead or not succeeding. And so you're like, okay, well, I kind of get it from that point of view. There's an even bigger storyline here where the entire path of mankind as a species moving forward is affected by Paul's actions in the first book. It begins, he's the catalyst for the beginning of a whole series of events which involve him and his son and the entire universe of human beings, which is where it ends up going into thousands of years into the future. So focusing only on the first novel or the first storyline is itself difficult because there's so much more coming, you know, and the implications of what Paul does and where he ends up going with it in the next book and the next story, was a little cut off at the knees by Denis Villeneuve in this interpretation of Dune in this part two. There were character actions that occurred specifically with Paul's concubine Chani, and who went way off character from what was in the books. And I don't mean in a woke way or some kind of like, you know, culturally modernized for a modern audience kind of way. It wasn't like that. It was a purposeful difference to make a point regarding the religious overtones and the Messiah thing. But I don't know why he did that. It didn't really make a lot of sense to me why he did that. You didn't have to have that character so blatantly, openly, obviously turning against Paul and the whole religious thing, as though her voice really meant a whole lot anyway, right? You had these, you know, millions of Fremen who really didn't care what she had to say about it. So it seemed like a really kind of meaningless, sort of protest or messaging in the middle of this movie that didn't need to be dumbed down that much, is kind of my disappointed take on that aspect of the story. I hope I'm being clear about that, and I won't belabor that point. I just felt they could have done that, made the points that Herbert makes in the book, which he makes over and over again, and which he makes very clearly through the events of the story. In other words, show, don't tell. They could have shown me all the things that they told me, and they did show me a lot in the course of the movie. And by the way, my whole critique here today is not telling you don't go see it. I am actually saying go see it, because the production values, the visuals, the framing, the direction, the costuming, like all the special effects, all the stuff that makes the movie a movie, is all top of the line, really, really well done. It's well put together, well executed in that sense. Story, they could have done better, right? Pacing, editing, it could have been better. It didn't need to be that long. There were parts that were given a lot of attention, and there were other parts that were given very minimal attention, which could have been explored a lot more. So it's kind of what was not there that I was more annoyed by than what was, because what was there was sort of like, yeah, they didn't need to spend this much time on this. I really wish they would have explored some of this other stuff. For example, Paul's sister, Aaliyah, and her birth or lack of it in the movie is a big change. And more importantly, though, is what the spice does to her. Paul's unborn sister is a prominent character, especially in the stories coming forward. And there was a change made in this movie from the books where she's not born early. And there's an awful lot of things to say. There's an awful lot of territory to explore in her character and what happens to her and what the spice does to her and her humanity and her sanity. And as an unborn, you know, fetus receiving this this ritual that is literally mind-altering and identity-altering in a way that nothing else ever could be. There's some really kind of weird stuff in Herbert's works as well with the genetic memory stuff. And if you thought Scientology's GE, or genetic entity that I explained a couple weeks ago, if you thought that was weird, Herbert's take on genetic memory is very bizarre. It's a very strange thing. And it's always made me feel a little uncomfortable reading his stuff, always trying to get my wits around it, because it's sort of this, you know, multiple personality based on the genetic memory of your relatives or your ancestors and stuff. And it's very weird. And there could have been a lot more explored about that in this as well, because of the Bene Gesserit, this group of women who've been affecting history for centuries, and, you know, their sort of machinations and Machiavellian plans and stuff. This was given very short shrift in the movie, and it really is a much larger theme in the story, in the books, and Herbert's writing. What the Bene Gesserit are doing is a very, very big, important part of the historical molding of the story, and it's really not given a whole lot of attention at all. So anyway, that's my kind of long take on that one. But I wanted to give I've been thinking about it ever since last night, so I had some thoughts. So there you go. All right, we got a lot of questions here. Let's get into them. The Elk of Antioch: I would so appreciate as deep a dive on Nation of Islam partnering with Scientology you could do. NOI has used murder in its leadership rivalries, meets with Congressional Black Caucus, and is a UFO cult. How could NOI make Scientology more politically powerful and more violent? Also, how could Scientology and NOI dovetail their respective UFO cosmologies? Okay, great questions. I've actually done a full video a few years ago about the Nation of Islam and its ties with Scientology and its background and its mythology. I did this work already, and it's on the channel here. So I will encourage you to look that up to get the full answer to the very good questions you're answering. I did not address, and I'll take up here, the Scientology and NOI dovetailing their UFO cosmologies. They don't really. They're very, very different. And I think they sort of are like melded on the concepts of Dianetics and the mind. And when it goes into the spiritual and people from the NOI start pursuing Scientology and moving up to the state of clear, they're doing so very much with the understanding of Dianetics and it being very much a mind and psychology type of practice, not so much a spiritual practice. I don't know, and frankly, I'm incredibly curious how NOI members do reconcile the NOI mythology, which is very specific and very black-centric and very, you know, historical revisionism, like you would not believe. It is an insanely wild history that is offered by the Nation of Islam as to human history, to say the least. And it definitely goes into UFO territory. But it's a very different mythology or setup from the Scientology mythology and background and Xenu and space aliens and invader forces and galactic, implant stations. And, Scientology's cosmology is, I've broken it down so many times here, is so bizarre and so unique to Hubbard and his way of thinking and modeling the universe that they really are kind of oil and water. I really don't see how they mesh. I've given it a lot of thought, and I just don't know. But it would be interesting, very interesting, if one day we could hear from somebody who is NOI, who somehow manages to, bust out of both of the cults and break it down for us as to, like, how did this make sense to you? Because it doesn't make any sense. It's already, neither one of these mythologies really make any sense. And mythologies don't necessarily have to, they're mythical and thematic and, often symbolic and that kind of thing. And that's kind of the nature of religious and moral, backgrounds and cultural legends and myths and stuff like that. Fine, right? Until you start taking it literally. And that's, what these two groups tend to do with these mythologies is they go, no, this is not just symbolic history and stories. This is what really happened, see? And it's impossible. It's impossible that what they think happened in the past, either way, it just doesn't make any damn sense, right? So, he is the Kwisatz Haderach, yes. Oh, don't even get me started on the Kwisatz Haderach and that whole thing. More Dune stuff there. So, what I will say is that it has really surprised me that there hasn't been more backlash against the Church of Scientology because of its partnering with the NOI. And it really tells you just how far down the dregs Scientology already is in the public eye, as in terms of its toxic PR. It really demonstrates just how bad it is that nobody's like, wait a minute, what the hell are the Scientologists doing with the Nation of Islam? It doesn't really surprise people that much. Like, it does, but at the same time, they're kind of like, yeah, okay. That doesn't make any sense at all, and yet, in a way, it kind of does, right? Because there's such obvious grifts. So let me spell that out, right? It's like the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, the people who lead that group, David Miscavige, the Church of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard, the people who lead that group, these people are such obvious grifters. They're just so blatantly obvious about it. It's like Joel Osteen. I mean, how do you not look at that guy and just think criminal? It's the first thing that comes to my mind. I can't help it. Guy's obviously a criminal. That's these guys, right? And I think most people really do get that and see it right off, even if they don't know all this or have to even get into all the specifics of the belief systems to prove it, right? Okay. I don't know. That's what I can say about that kind of off the top of my head. But seriously, El Gavaniak, check out my Nation of Islam video. You can just do a search on my channel for Nation of Islam. It'll come right up. And there's a whole dive on that. And check that out. And then if you still have questions about this after that, get back to me. Because it's an interesting topic for sure. Sure. Okay, here's a great question. X-Cyan, have you done a show about all the implant methods used on the whole track? Bubblegum, the pole trap, etc. I have not. I did do a little bit of a dive one time. I think in one show I talked about, I think I did a live stream like about, it was sometime in the last year and a half, where I did the cosmology of Scientology. There is definitely a show on that. But let's talk about this for a minute, because implants are whack and they are some of Hubbard's like craziest inventions. The idea with an implant in Scientology is that you take this. This is stuff that was generally done a long time ago. There are still stations, automated facilities, you could say, set up on planet Earth, on Mars, apparently on Venus, and in other places in the universe, sometimes floating around in space, sometimes on other planets. They have some kind of mechanism for drawing in or attracting the attention of a disembodied thetan. Maybe they put out pulses, or maybe they look really nice, or they're very interesting, or, you know, there's something about them that go, oh, shiny thing, what's that, right? And a thetan will be drawn to it. Regardless of how a thetan ends up in it, whether it's, you know, by being drawn into it, or being pushed into it, or forced into it, or tractor beamed into it, an implant is a set of actions or very forceful. How do I put this? It's a whole process that a thetan is basically put through. It's like a car wash. Analogize it to a car wash. If you go in one end, you come out the other, and you're not the same as when you went in. The implant station, whatever it does to you, whether it spins you at a million miles an hour, like literally, or whether it, you know, bops you up and down, or whether it electric shocks you with, you know, with high powered voltages of electricity that Hubbard says are so powerful they haven't even been invented on Earth yet. You know, what would it take to shock a thetan, right? Well, apparently a lot. I don't really understand how a thetan could be shocked by anything, but, you know, Hubbard says it happens. And he talks in History of Man, and later on in some bulletins in the 1960s about very specific implants and implant stations, such as the Gorilla Goals, where you're in some kind of amusement park situation and you're drawn into it and these gorillas come out. I'm doing this all off the top of my head, okay? So I might be mixing a few of these things. But these gorillas come out and, you know, and start beating on you or something and telling you commands, and they're giving you like really basic command, you know, sleep, eat, you know, this kind of stuff, like weird, a lot of sleep, a lot of like go to sleep, a lot of knock yourself out kind of stuff. And the idea, there was another set of implants connected with a place called Heliotropus, a planet or a society, which were called the Heaven implants. And apparently those implants were all about, you know, how you were going to go to some celestial palace or beautiful location, and there were clouds, you know, sort of electrical clouds or something connected with this incident, right? Because of the planet and the surface of it and how it was permanently covered in clouds. I mean, you can kind of see the imagination of Hubbard just kind of running wild. I mean, and he just thinks up anything, and oh, okay, here we go. It's a circus. It's a Maginot cloud. It's a planet. It's a painting. It's, you know, it's whatever you want it to be, right? These implants take all these different crazy forms. A bubblegum incident, for example, was some kind of a sticky sort of fly trap kind of thing, right? Where, you know, you energy is being used against the thetan to keep him stuck to a surface. And every time he's trying to use energy to pull himself off, this energy is coming back around and sticking him back onto it as though it's acting like bubblegum or a fly trap or something, right? Pole trap is just, here's a pole. It's just a pole. I don't know how big it is. You know, maybe it's like the 2001 monolith. It's a pole, and it emits a hum or a vibration, and the thetan's like, what's that? And then he comes up to it, and wham, he's stuck to it, right? Because it's got some magnetic pole or energy or something, and it just keeps, you know, letting him go and pulling him back, right? And so keeps smacking the thetan. It just keeps bitch slapping him, right? And apparently during this process, commands are given. And who knows what they are. They could be anything. There's so many different kinds of implants, implanting so many different ideas, that Hubbard asserts that that's one of the reasons we're all so crazy, is because of all of the thousands and thousands of you know, hundreds of thousands of millions of implants we've received. And not only that we have received, but that we have also delivered to others, because during the course of our existence in this universe, we have been the victim, but we have also been the victimizer many, many, many times. And that's what makes it, that's what makes it stick. So, oh, Elka Vandiak, I didn't realize you were NOI. You were an NOI entry level student. Yes, please do watch my video, and please do reach out to me, and let's email or let's talk about that after you've watched that. Okay, because I'd be very curious to hear your reactions to it. Maybe we can just communicate that way. Okay, cool. All right, let's carry on here with the questions. Does any other religion or cult than Scientology use more methods or techniques to get people in and convince them to give up their money? Is Scientology the best at it? Scientology is certainly not the best at it, especially now. They are one of the worst at it. That's one of the things that Alex and I and others, you know, over the years have just been in wide-eyed amazement at, is how bad David Miscavige is at running Scientology and actually getting it, doing its thing effectively. He doesn't understand his own con. That's what absolutely blows me away about David Miscavige, is how ignorant he is of the very mechanisms that make Scientology do what it does. You know, I was going to say work, but it, you know, it doesn't work, not the way it says it does, but it works the way he intended it for it to, right? As L. Ron Hubbard Jr. said. I'm not aware of any of many techniques and methods of control as Scientology does. Once they get their claws into you, you know, once you are, oh, okay. Hope everything is well there. Yeah, okay, good. Looks like we're still good. I just got this little message, OBS reconnection. I was like, whoa, what's that? Okay, I think we're good. Once they get their claws into you, so to speak, right? Once they have you, there are so many things they do to you that, and a lot of it being done under your awareness, right? Without you even really necessarily tracking with what's going on. Like, for example, the auditing sessions and stuff. You know, it's only sometimes rings a little bit of a red flag of people when they realize that they're going into an auditing session where the auditor is sitting on the other side of the room and the door out of this room is behind the auditor. And if they want to leave, they got to go through him. Like, it doesn't, that calculus doesn't start occurring right away. Right? But it's a little bit of a subtle control mechanism, a subtle one. It's not so subtle if you get up and try to leave the room. That's when it becomes a very blatant and obvious control mechanism, because you ain't leaving the auditing room until the auditor allows you to. That's a bit more heavy-handed. That you know, the heavy glove come, you know, the velvet glove comes off when things get tense or when things get, you know, rough or whatever. But that's not always super obvious at the beginning, is kind of the point I'm trying to make here, is it's that level of control, that heavy-handed control, is always present. It's just you're not necessarily aware of it. Okay. Same with the word clearing. Same with the, you know, the stuff they do in the classrooms, right? It's like you're going to get this information. You know, if we have to kill you to get it across to you, right? We don't care what we're going to, what kind of process we're going to have to go through, you know, to ram this information down your throat in such a way that you are, yes, sir, no, sir, how high, sir. That's what we're going to do, right? It's like that kind of an approach. We'd rather have you dead than incapable, as Hubbard says, in keeping Scientology working, the most important policy in Scientology. You know, so it's a pretty heavy-handed approach, but it's very velvet glove at the, you know, at the, on the surface, right? It appears to align with the idea of restoring your self-determinism. It appears to be not hypnotizing you. It appears to be anti-hypnotism, right? But it's none of those things. It's everything it says it's not. And that itself is another level of what we, you know, gaslighting and control. So many levels, right? With the TRs, with the word clearing, with the metering, with the very existence of an e-meter is itself like wildly off the rails for a therapeutic approach like science, like they pretend to be doing in auditing. Yeah, so not good stuff. Okay. Good question. Okay, let's carry on here. X-Cyan, after your thank you for asking me this one. After your e-meter video, will you kind of stop answering questions about Scientology? No, I will still answer questions about it. The Q&A shows that I do here are meant to answer anything you want to know from me. And a lot of people want to know a lot of Scientology stuff. I'm not putting a kibosh on that. I'm not going to limit what I'm going to answer. I'm totally fine with that. Okay. What I'm not going to be doing is I'm not going to be making any more videos dedicated only to breaking down Scientology principles or concepts or techniques. I've done it. All right. That's all there for you guys. And I'm serious. I really want you to use the search button on my channel. There's so much stuff here for you. Man, so much stuff. So many interviews, so many discussions, so many breakdowns of every aspect of Scientology. Oh, and by the way, don't forget, as I might as well plug this, don't forget I have a whole other channel called Critical Clips. That channel has now, I think it's like 1,200 videos or something. Like, there's a lot of videos there. Most of them answers from my Q&A videos, right? I'm still years back in pulling those questions from my older Q&A shows and posting them Monday through Friday on that Clips channel, right? So there is so much stuff there that you can search. TRs, meter, Hubbard, Miscavige, con man, right? A cult, like that, recovery. You use those key kind of words to search through that channel, you're going to have like so many answers to so many questions that I've given in the past on this stuff. So I want to throw that out there for you guys. But no, I'm not going to stop answering questions about Scientology here in this format. Okay. Yes, Joe DiCeppo. Any thoughts on the Tucker Carlson Putin propaganda quote unquote interview? I have very simple and direct thoughts about Tucker Carlson. He is the very epitome of what you would call a propagandist. He is an anti-American, anti-democratic, traitorous scumbag, as far as I'm concerned. That's Tucker Carlson. But he's mostly an opportunist, right? The man is a dolt. I mean, he's really not very smart. He will say anything. If it will make him money or get him influence or forward his agenda, which is all about forwarding Tucker Carlson as a person. He has no principles. He stands for nothing, right? And so him going over and doing a propaganda video about the joys of shopping at a grocery store in Russia, I mean, I had to just... What am I looking at right now? You know, this is somebody who considers themselves and positions himself as a serious person. Exactly the opposite, right? This is not entertainment. This is disinfotainment in the worst possible way. I mean, Putin himself, you know, thought the guy was a joke and treated him like a joke because he is. That's Tucker Carlson, right? The man is just a walking joke. If you can see him for what he is. And there are, and it really bothers me that anybody really takes that guy seriously. And that's my rant on Tucker Carlson. Yeah, Benson didn't seem too put out by Daylight Savings Time X-Cyan. he seemed right with it. This is a good question. I'm going to say that I don't know the answer, but do you know if the current overturn of Roe v. Wade abortion has had any effect on Scientology's policies about it? I am not, I am not aware of any changes in Scientology's policies as a result of Roe v. Wade. They were, you know, publicly anti-abortion when it suits them, privately pro-abortion when it suits them. They're a little bit all over the place, right? The Scientology's official position on anything is whatever suits them in the moment. That's kind of the real truth of it. So, yeah. So I don't think that there was any, I don't think Roe v. Wade is really changing or challenging Scientology's views on it, because Scientology's views on it were never, ever based on Roe v. Wade or anything having to do with that. Individual Scientologists, don't get me wrong, absolutely, right? Some Scientologists are very, very pro-abortion. Some Scientologists are very, very anti, right? I mean, you can have lots of different individual views about this. But I'm taking this from, you know, what's the position of the Church of Scientology officially? You know, it's abortions are bad because L. Ron Hubbard said attempted abortions are bad, which isn't even logically consistent. You know, we'll let the mother decide. I mean, I don't even know if Scientology has even issued an official statement or position on it as such, you know, now that I think about it. Okay, next question. Also from X Cyan. Did you know people who aggrandized L. Ron Hubbard almost to the point of worship? I mean, my first thought is yes, but now I'm trying to think about, well, who? Let's see here. I mean, I definitely talked to people who had stars in their eyes about L. Ron Hubbard when I was in Scientology. I never considered him a godlike figure. I didn't worship at the feet of L. Ron Hubbard, and I didn't really meet a lot of people who did. Yeah. Not worship, aggrandize to the point of, almost to the point of worship. Oh, yeah, Fluffy, you're right. Yeah, pro-choice. Fair enough. Yeah. You're not wrong about that. Yeah, I just didn't see anybody worshiping L. Ron Hubbard. I just never saw that. Right, I can't really think of any instance where I really saw that. But I saw people who had very starry eyes, you know, kind of a glazed look, a little bit of that, you know, kind of thing. The cult look, right, about him. I saw that. Yeah, I think that's all I'll say about that. Jehovah's Witness apostate, Chris, does Arthur Hubbard still have some ties with Scientology? If he does, I'm not aware of them. I not that I know of. Oh, okay, Leslie Bishop. All right, here's a question. What topic do you plan to discuss when you begin writing a new book? Cult recovery. That's all I'm saying. Matt. Hey, Matt. Matt B, you said recently that cults are not about win-wins. For example, Scientology made you into an enemy unnecessarily. Why is it impossible for cults to pursue win-win outcomes despite it being in their interest? What a great question. That is because cults are, if we listen to or pay attention to personality theory, right, personality psychology, identity psychology, then we know that cult members are all about assuming the identity or taking on the characteristics of the cult leader. What that means for the group as a whole, if you think that thought through, is that the group is a reflection of the personality of the cult leader as a whole. The group acts as a mirror to the cult leader's desires, wishes, goals, and purposes. And so the traits of the cult leader, how the cult leader goes about his day-to-day and attacking enemies and dealing with adversarial relationships is reflected in the cult, right? The dogma of the cult, it doesn't even necessarily need to be written down, but it often is. Like we get fair gaming in Scientology, which is a great example. So let's use that. L. Ron Hubbard literally encoded his own vindictive nature into the dogma of Scientology, into its writings and its lectures. And that reflection is then carried out in the behavior of Scientologists. They have no choice but to follow the dicta of L. Ron Hubbard. So L. Ron Hubbard, like every single cult leader out there, destructive cult leader, was a vindictive motherfucker, right? The guy hated people who didn't get along with him. He wanted them dead. He wanted them gone. He wanted them destroyed. He wanted them out of his space, out of his life forever. He didn't want to ever have anything to do with them again. And preferably, he wanted them gone in the most painful way possible, right? Carve out his heart with a spoon, right? Why a spoon? Because it hurts more. Right? It's that kind of approach. They are generally that way, that you don't have destructive cult leaders who are kind, generous, compassionate people. These things don't go together. And a cult, as a group, has the characteristic of being reflective of the personality of the leader. That codependency is a lot more than just a personal, individual thing. It's a group thing. So, at least as I see it, right? This is how I see it. And so, this is why the cult members, even people who have never met L. Ron Hubbard, will act towards ex-members just like L. Ron Hubbard would. Ruin them utterly. Destroy them in the most painful way possible. And that precludes, that absolutely denies any possibility of a win-win. Or a live and let live, or turn the other cheek. Scientology, I mean, hell, I think Heber's the one. Heber Gentz, who's generally, you know, was capable of being a compassionate man. Talk about a weaponized empath. Heber Gentz, oh my God. And I think one of the things he said one time, right, was Scientology's not a turn the other cheek religion. Yeah, we don't do that. You come after us, we come after you and your family and every contact you've ever had, and we salt the earth. You know, that's Scientology. That's destructive cults. So, yeah. Oh, good question. I wish I knew the answer. OBG Foster, of the people you worked with when you left, what percent are still in versus percent versus out versus percent unknown? Well, let me do the little math here. Not sure, but what I can say is that everybody that I worked with in management is no longer in management. I know that two, three, four, five. Yeah, I know most of the people that I used to work with at CLO in FOLO and in management of West US are no longer doing those jobs. And I know that 30% of them are no longer in the Sea Org. This is just what I know off the top of my head. I'm not saying that's the objective figure because I don't know. But that's what I do know. So I can say that's what I can say about that. And I'll leave it at that. Young Matador, hey, Chris, how are cults able to bring people back in to their belief system? Tom Cruise being probably the best known example, during the 90s, according to defectors, he was almost out of the Church of Scientology. Okay, Young Matador, I'm going to answer this, but I'm also going to say that I literally just answered this in a live stream we did this week about emotional needs. I'm always just going to promote, you know, my other stuff too, because that's what I do here. Because I want you all to watch it. It's good stuff. But in answer to your question, it's very simple. Because I used to do this. I used to literally go knocking on people's doors and get them back into Scientology. And I'll tell you exactly how you do it, is you rehabilitate their failed purposes. In other words, you find out what emotional need or needs were being fulfilled by Scientology for this person in their life back in the day when they were Scientologists? What was it that appealed to you about it? What did you get out of it? What was fun? What was interesting? What was giving you the wins? Where were your wins coming from? What happened that you liked? Right? The answer to any of those questions, any and all of those questions, is what I'm looking for. I'm trying to dig that up out of you because it's still buried in there. And I know if I can rehabilitate that, because it's a dead subject to you now. You left, you lost hope. You no longer think Scientology or whatever the group is that we're part of. This applies across the boards, any group, anytime, anywhere, any human being. I'll go all the way out on that limb, and I will say that what I'm about to tell you, or what I'm telling you right now, applies universally. Okay. Obviously, there will be people with pathologies who will have exceptions to this. Generally speaking, human beings across the boards have emotional needs, and generally speaking, those emotional needs can be the subject of hope and failed hope. Right? You try to accomplish something, you want to succeed at something, and you fail. Ugh. And you give up, right? And you don't do that anymore. We've all done it. We've all done it. Somebody else comes along later on and says, yeah, but, right? What was it about that? And if it was something you really were invested in and it was really meaningful to you, it's probably still there. There's probably still something, some little spark of something that could be rekindled. And that is the target, is find out what that is, right? And then get the person, convince the person, restore the person's faith in that thing that we can do. We can still do something about it. Oh, you got into Scientology because you wanted to have better relationships with your family, and things went south because the ethics officer told you that you had to disconnect from your mom. Ah, and you never were going to disconnect from your mom because you love your mom. Of course you didn't want to disconnect from your mom. Who would want to disconnect from their mom? I would never want that. Let's take a look at this again. What was your mom doing? Oh my God, and see, it doesn't really matter to me right here as I'm talking to them in the here and now. I don't give a shit what mom did. I don't care, right? Unless mom was like a flaming SP who went on TV denouncing Scientology, which they never were, I'm not going to worry about it, right? Because I'm trying to get this guy back into Scientology. So it's like, oh, well, what did your mom do? Oh, she talked shit about Scientology to me. And the ethics officer said I had to disconnect from her. Oh, that was off the rails, man. Come on. That's not how this works. Here, let me show you the policy right here. See, you're supposed to handle before you disconnect. Really? Yeah. See, there's this whole handle step and they didn't do that. Look at this. We can fix this. Come on, right? And, whoa, you could fix it? Yeah, we can get you back into Scientology. You can get back on the track, and you can talk to your mom. It's no big deal. Like, let's figure this out, right? Oh, well, maybe I could come back. You know, you got $1,000 on account right now. You don't even have to give me any money. Come on down. Let's talk. And you get him back. I did it. I don't know how this comes across to you all as to whether you believe this or not, if this sounds plausible to you. I'm not sure. I really don't know. But I am describing to you the kind of conversations I used to have with people. And these worked. And I got people back. And I got a lot of people back doing this. So that's why I think this is what works. You know, and I didn't know at the time that I was playing on their emotional needs, and I didn't feel I was taking advantage of them. I thought I was giving them their eternity back. You know, to me, this was a mission, and I was very much a man on a mission, literally and figuratively, right? So anyway, yeah, so that's how we did it. You know, how do other people do it? Restoring faith, restoring belief, right? Bringing them back from the dead, fanning those flames of faith. You know, that's kind of how you do it. People are malleable, and that's that's how it works. All right, great questions today. I'm really loving this, guys. Okay. Wow. I can't believe again, we are an hour in. Let's take a look at this. An ethics officer told a victim of Masterson it was her duty to have sex with him. Where does this patriarchal attitude come from? In other words, Scientology is quite egalitarian. For example, women in leadership. Oh, yeah, that comes from L. Ron Hubbard and Mary Sue Hubbard. The idea that a spouse or a sexual partner owes sex to Danny Masterson, let's say, in this specific example, comes out of the concepts of exchange in Scientology, first off, right? There needs to be even exchange between partners. And if Masterson's the breadwinner, and if Masterson is the guy who's bringing in, you know, the influence and the money and support and all of that, where what's she bringing to this equation? Well, you know, she can have sex with him, right? So that's how she can balance out the exchange, okay? That's the first thing, is you got to understand this exchange thing. It's really, really important in Scientology. They take that stuff really seriously, especially in relationships, right, where it's all about exchange. Because you don't want to be, because conversely, I think we could all easily agree, where we might go, well, that sounds nuts, but we would readily agree that we wouldn't want to be in a relationship that is out exchange. She's taking all your money. He's taking, you know, advantage of your time or your will or your this or that, right? He, she, it can go both ways, right? But whichever way it goes, and however the relationship is structured, if one person's doing all the heavy lifting and the other is just along for the ride, it's an out exchange situation. We all agree that that would be not right, right? We all think that's not cool. Sugar daddies and sugar mamas and, you know, and riding the easy train and not giving as much as you're getting and that kind of thing. We all think that that's wrong. Well, this is how Scientologists interpret that. I didn't say all that to make it sound like it's reasonable to demand sex from your partner like they did in Scientology. I'm not saying that's reasonable. I'm saying the concept of exchange is something that we can all get on board with, and that's how they get you. That's how they get you in Scientology. They go, well, this makes sense, right? And you go, yeah, well, then your bit of the exchange here, miss, right? And there it is. That's one aspect of that. The other place this comes from is some old school thinking in Scientology as written by, in a pamphlet that was written by Mary Sue Hubbard about how to be a good wife, how to be a good partner, right? What the wife, I think that was written up as the wife hat, right? Kind of like the student hat, you know, you have a hat for a specialized job that you do. That's a Scientology term. And so if you're being a student, you put on your student hat. Well, if you're being a wife, you put on your wife hat. And in this book, this pamphlet from Mary Sue, maybe I should find that and we can go over it sometime. That might be interesting. You know, she talks about this stuff, right? About how you're supposed to be a support and, you know, bolster your husband and that sort of thing and be there for him and all that. So it could have come out of that too. Okay, so that's what I've got for you on that. All right, got a few questions in the queue here. Let's see if I can pop through these real fast as some flash answers, and we can wrap up here today. Jehovah's Witness apostate, does the U.S. still use electroshock? Is it illegal to use it in 2024? Yes, it is still used. Electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, is still a treatment modality used in fairly significant and heavy-duty forms of depression, anxiety. Other kinds of mental disorders can be subject to that. It's not used as frequently as it used to be, and it is not done the same way. It's a little bit more humane in terms of the drugs and the look and feel of it, but it's still ECT. And I know it's controversial, and I know a lot of people have very, you know, ideas about it, right? And I'm not necessarily for it or against it. I think it's incredibly context-specific. But generally speaking, I'm not really much of a proponent for it. I guess if I had to measure myself on it, I'd put myself more in the negative camp on it. But I'm told, and I've read legit, actual peer-reviewed, real stuff that shows that there are percentages of cases where it really has helped, like legit has helped on a long-term basis. So I can't just like go, well, that's not true, because it is true. But, you know, that's, but no, it's not illegal. Oh my God, guys, this is wonderful. Did you know the son of Karen Delacarrier? Will you interview her? Yes, I did know Alexander Gentsch. I knew him quite well, and I did an entire video about his tragic death and my feelings about it. And I interviewed Karen in that video. I've also interviewed Karen many other times on this channel. Please check out the search button on my channel and check it out. It's called A Tragedy in Three Acts. It is one of the most impactful and meaningful videos I feel that I've ever produced. It was definitely a personal thing for me to make that video. And I broke down the entire story of Alex and what the church did to him and the consequences and outcomes of that. So check it out. Think about this one here. The theme of Dark Knight Rises is hope, and one of the movie's lessons is that there is no true despair without hope. Does that reflect your experience in the Scientology cult and on the RPF in particular? What a thought-provoking question, Matt. Thanks for asking me that.
I
would say that definitely reflects my experience. Hope, despair, right? These to me are sort of polar opposites. So can you have one without the other? No, because one sort of defines the other, right? That's what polar opposites are all about. That's what generates spectrums in the first place, right? I'd say that reflects. For me, the RPF was certainly a place where I had almost all the hope sucked out of me for the first few weeks I was there. And I was in a really, really, really bad way. And I needed to have some hope injected back into me. I had to sort of self-generate it as I remember the experience. I remember talking to other people, but other people were not really super helpful to me at that time. It was sort of a, you know, shut the fuck up and just, you know, start treading water, right? Because otherwise you're going to drown and we're just going to sit here and watch you do it. So get to treading, right? And I did. I didn't let myself drown. And then eventually I, you know, once they saw that I was wanting to get through the program, then they started putting me through the program, you know? Not sure what else to say about this exactly. Like your question, yes, I see it reflecting the experience, but I'm not sure exactly what else to say about it than that. So I guess I don't know where else to go with that. So I'll just leave it at that. Do you debate? I know of some women who would like to. Marissa, Dana, and Virginia. Do I debate? No, I don't. I'll just leave it at that. I would be willing to debate about things that are not interpersonal drama. How about that? Red Pill 3000, do you think that Jehovah's Witnesses is a cult? If so, why? Yes, I do believe that the Jehovah's Witnesses are a cult because of the medical restrictions and deaths involved with that, the cover-up of child and women's sexual abuse to a degree that is rampant and disgusting, and the strictures on shunning and disconnection, and the fact that if you don't toe the line, you are relegated to a life of, you know, destitution and spiritual desolation, right? And They wouldn't really care less about that. So, because you've gone against the group, right? It's the us versus them, right? Black and white thinking. So there's a lot of check boxes that are checked when you look at the Jehovah's Witnesses as an activity, as a group, as an institution, not just on an individual level, but institutionally, what are they doing? They're doing this, and they're doing this, and they're doing this, and they're doing this. That makes them a cult. So that's how I see the JWs. And and there's a lot of really good. I'm just gonna. Today is just plug day, I guess. You know, there's a lot of good stuff on this channel about that. When I specifically my old Sensibly Speaking podcast episodes called The Three Apostates. There were about 10 or so episodes we did where we compared and contrasted Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, and Scientology in detail, from child sexual assault and child behavior to how they treat women, to how the beliefs work, to how the shunning works, to all kinds of stuff we covered in those podcasts. So I highly recommend you check those out. And I hope in the future to do a lot more exploration of Jehovah's Witnesses as a group. You'll definitely see more in the future from me on that. Oh my God. Who do you think would win in a fight between ninjas and Vikings? Oh, I love these questions. The Vikings, absolutely the Vikings. You know, they're big dudes with big axes and hammers and, you know, swords. They're going to definitely win. Okay, Joe DiCeppo, how long on average does it take you to edit your podcasts? Generally speaking, it takes me about a time and a half of the length of them. So if it's an hour podcast, an hour and a half, right? If it's a 2-hour podcast, or if then it's one and a half times. Yeah. Anyway, something like that, about that, right? If you take the length of it, add on maybe another half or so, and that's what you get in terms of editing time. But sometimes it's a lot faster. It depends on the podcast and the person I was talking to. Because sometimes there's just no editing at all. I still go through every minute and rewatch the whole thing and put it all together. But sometimes the editing is really just a matter of rewatching it. It goes that fast. So yeah, it depends. There can be other times when I'm putting prep together for something like the tone scale video, right? Where I did that whole PowerPoint and all that work. That was days and days of work. So it, you know, so it kind of balances out. Polar Vortex. Hey, Chris, I'm pretty sure it was Hubbard who thought of disconnection, or was it Miscavige? It was Hubbard. Absolutely. No question about it. Scientology disconnection was definitely a brainchild of L. Ron Hubbard. Okay, good. And with that, we have reached the end of the questions. Yeah. So there we go. We're going to wrap up the show for today. I want to thank everybody for coming around and watching here today. This was fun. This was good. Yeah, we had a good show. And you will see after Scientology, Straight Up and Vertical, Tony and I will be recording that, in fact, in an hour from now. So I'll be putting that together for you guys. And other than that, I'm going to be pretty flat out this week on the metering stuff. At least that's my plan. And various other, you know, this is and that's and whatever. Let me please put out another plug to you guys, one last one for today, on my consultations. I very much would encourage you to reach out and contact me if you have any questions, concerns, issues in your life with coercive control, cults, post-cult work or activity. You want to talk to me one-on-one about this stuff. You feel it might be able to help you in your own life or in friends or family, something like that. If you have a friend or a family member who's involved in a coercive situation, maybe we can do something about it. And of course, you know, cult intervention type stuff. So feel free to contact me via my website, mncriticalthinking.com, or askchrisshelton@gmail.com. You can always email me, and let's talk. And of course, like I said, I've always got my book, Scientology A to Xenu, here. All right, those are my plugs. I will see you guys soon. Bye-bye.